I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. It wasn't so much a debate in New Hampshire last night as a positioning contest. Al Gore got labeled the bunker candidate. Bill Bradley was tagged as the ivory tower professor.
I think you're in the Washington bunker. And I can understand why you're in the bunker. I mean, there was Gingrich, there was the fundraising scandals, there was the impeachment problem. And I think that the major objective in the last several years in the White House has been political survival. I understand that. But the reality is the Democratic Party shouldn't be in the Washington bunker with you.
The presidency is not an academic exercise. It's not an extended seminar on theory. It has to be a daily fight for the best interests of the American people. The position of president is the only position filled by somebody who is charged with a responsibility for fighting for all of the people. If I make a mistake, I'll do my best to own up to it and then to learn from it and learn from you about how we can deal with the reality as we find it and then work together to shape that reality to make this a better country.
This is starting to look like a real cockfight for the Democratic nomination. The choice is obviously between two substantive, smart, serious professionals. There are some big liberal ideas on the table, universal health care coverage, gays in the military. But for voters in New Hampshire who've been up close and personal with Al Gore and Bill Bradley for months now, the choice may just come down to style as much as substance. A choice between the senator's son from the Fairfax Hotel in Washington and the aging athlete from Missouri, Princeton, Oxford, and the New York Knicks. We're scoring last night's Democratic presidential debate this hour. Connection listeners, what were you seeing and hearing from New Hampshire last night? Is there going to be a real choice here? 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK makes the Democratic debate connection. Michael Kelly, veteran Washington reporter, new editor of the Atlantic Monthly, joins us in the studio. Bill Curry joins us by phone from Connecticut. He was a counselor to the president in Bill Clinton's White House from 94 to 96. He ran for governor of Connecticut in 1994. Start with you, Michael Kelly. What were you looking at last night?
I thought that was a great debate last night. I would like them to postpone the New Hampshire debate for a couple of weeks here at least so we could have more of them. I think there's a reasonable chance at this point that if we do that and we have more debates, that at some point one or the other of these guys will actually bite the other. Fellow, and I'd like to see that. I have a
draw
sort of,
blood. You mean?
No, I don't know if it would be blood. I think if in Gore's case, I think there might be sort of some Pekingese nips, a lot of them around the ankle. I think Bradley would probably sort of more mastiff style, just sort of grab Gore's arm and hold on to it till the fire hoses.
A lot of saliva.
A lot of sort of growling.
And maybe a certain big old boy affection, too. Who knows?
Yeah, you might just sort of shake him.
What were you learning last night? I know what you mean. This is getting to be sort of fun.
It is getting to be fun. And one thing that that fascinated me about last night, and it's something that has been running through the campaign to date, and I think it matters in the bigger context of the race and the politics of our times, is the failure of both men or the refusal of both men to run away from the liberal label. And they were both given an opportunity to do this thing that Democratic candidates are supposed to have to do to win, the Dukakis lesson. When somebody says liberal, you actually leave the room. And they were given the chance to do it, and they didn't do it. They said, if that's what you want to call me, you can call me that. An open invitation. Now, I think there's a reason for that. And the reason has to do with Bill Clinton's greatest political legacy is to redefine democratic liberalism into something that I think both of these candidates are betting on may actually be safe to be again. To take the three things that made it unsafe to be a democratic liberal, I think, and I'd love to hear what Bill Curry says about this, is a kind of soft on crime a position, a fealty to a failed criminal philosophy of treating crime and a failed philosophy of treating welfare, and a kind of 1970s, 1980s, what was caricatured as sort of blame America first attitude on foreign policy. The last 8 years, it's very hard to say that is the face of democratic liberalism right now. And the other aspects of democratic liberalism, redistributing wealth in some ways, giving perks and benefits to the vast middle class and so on, using the government to soak the rich and give to the middle class. These have always been popular. It may be that this is an election where you're going to see where people say, yeah, I'm a liberal, and what do you want to make of it?
It's interesting. Ted Kennedy was endorsing Al Gore yesterday, and that did mean the big L sort of blessing. It done in Boston, done again in New Hampshire. Apparently he'll go to Iowa with him. They think this is working. But are you saying this is foolhardy, Michael, or courageous, or just plain a wise reading of the winds here?
I don't know if it's foolhardy or courageous, but I do know, or at least I think, that at least in the Clinton-Gore strategists, I don't know as much about the Bradley, but some time ago, I think, decided that the emergent political majority in this country was the factual demographic majority, a suburban majority, and that suburban majority, which used to be Republican, is increasingly Democrat, and is not uncomfortable with the label liberal. And that this, I think this gamble is, at least to some degree, conscious. And whether it works or not, I don't know.
Bill Curry, what do you think? This is rather blithe, you know, call me liberal, call me progressive, anything you want, I don't care.
I think, first of all, I think Michael's on the right track. I would say it slightly differently, that certainly the Democratic candidate for office in many years, since I registered to vote, Democrats have carried three pieces of baggage into every contest. Soft on crime, soft on welfare, and I'd say for the third tax and spend. And one of the great gifts of William Jefferson Clinton to the Democratic Party was that he became the first Democrat to seek public office at a high level to be more trusted than Republicans on, for instance, crime. And he did it not as the Republicans whined by stealing their positions. He did it literally by stealing the issue. The Brady Bill, 100,000 cops, community-based policing. He showed a more effective strategy for dealing with crime. But the main thing is he took it off the table. Now, the second phase, once you finally lay that baggage down, what do you stand for positively? Clinton basically said in 92, I'm a new Democrat. I can cut your taxes and shrink your government and devolve power, and I can still extend a social contract, heal cities, extend health care, enhance job security. And I think the question on the table in the Democratic primary, although it isn't perhaps articulated as such, is can you? Can you do that? Can you do those two things? What does separate a new Democrat from a Republican? You know, a Republican, at the end of the day, if you've cut a tax or deregulated a market, you know, go home. You've had a great day. You kick back, have a drink, and congratulate yourself. The Democrat still knows, theoretically, that there are pressing issues of great magnitude for the country to face. The challenge to both Bradley and Gore, I believe, is to demonstrate that that promise of Clinton in 92 especially, that was actually not just a centrist incremental promise. There were huge issues, comprehensive campaign finance, health care and welfare reform, comprehensive cities and education reform. Can you actually, if you will, pursue Democratic objectives by more Republican methods? Without command and control bureaucracies, without incessant tax increases. Is that really possible? I would conclude by saying I think that it is, but without pain.
Bill Curry, where is the argument between Gore and Bradley over these things? I mean, and who's got the sort of triangulated Bill Clinton sort of responsibility Democrats, somewhat neoconservative position here? Or where has that position gone?
I think two things. One, the interesting thing of it, people have joked about Clinton that he's obsessed with his legacy. If to whatever degree that's true, he must be thrilled looking at the debate in both parties. If you take what I regard as the major issues, if you look at the budget, where, you know, 4 years ago, Bob Dole had to adopt Steve Forbes' massive across-the-board tax cut. If you look at the attitudes toward technology or world trade, it's difficult not just to separate out Gore and Bradley, but Gore and Bradley from McCain and Bush. And the real question, I think both candidates last night, as Michael said right on the money, there was a lot of positioning. But there wasn't the explanation of how you really get new Democratic solutions.
But Bill, I'd say there is one, and this isn't a detail thing, but the clear thematic thing in the debate last night. It's come up again, and there is one difference, a difference of approach here, that Bradley, I think, is genuinely running as the guy who says, all right, there were big ideas on the table in 92. There was a lot of stuff in putting people first. There was a promise of a large activist government, and now let's move forward in a very large way. And Al Gore is running as the incrementalist. Let's not go too far here. Let's take this the safe, sensible step at a time. And Bradley, I thought last night, was very clear in saying, look, you have a choice of who you're going to vote for. Maybe I am more risky, but this is not the kind of thing that being a little risky didn't stop FDR, and it didn't stop other great activists from doing what they wanted to do. Let's go forward and try the big stuff now.
I think one of the things that each of these guys faces, though, is that while a majority of voters have simply walked out of the system and stopped participating, the ones who were left are paying very close attention, which is good news. You know, the bad news in our is that money drives our politics, but the good news is that increasingly ideas do as well. And what to go back to that question of what Clinton promised, it was very thematic. I think Bradley reminds me in some ways of Gary Hart. Gary Hart had new ideas. Bradley has big ideas. Gary Hart talked about destiny. Bradley talked about the appropriateness of his candidacy to the moment. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is that in the first Clinton administration, by 1993, Clinton could give the new Democratic health care speech in his sleep, mm-hmm. but nobody could write the new Democratic health care plan. Think how refreshing it would have been to sit there last night when they got to health care and have Bradley say, geez, for the life of me, I couldn't figure out where the Medicare money comes from, mm-hmm. or how you actually replace Medicaid with a system that pays for adequate health care. And for Gore to turn and say, you know, I'm having the same problem. That's why I left the entire middle class out of my proposal. There's a real reach here, an intellectual reach.
Could I ask you both about the so-called mistakes that Al Gore wanted Bill Bradley to confess? It seemed to me interesting. Bradley was a little bit to the right of the parade in voting for some of the Reagan tax cuts. He was really on the left side of the Clinton thing on welfare reform. He thought it was a little foolhardy, without really guarantees for the safety net, which seemed to sort of balance out. What Al Gore didn't mention at all was Bill Bradley's votes for the Contra War under Ronald Reagan in Central America. What's to make of these so-called mistakes?
Well, I don't know how Bill feels about this, but one thing I thought that in that exchange, at least, was that Bradley came off fairly well because he did two things. One, he said he didn't try to ex post facto rationalize or escape from his decisions. He said, no, these are the decisions I made, but here are the reasons I made them, and I stand by them. You may think they're wrong, but I had a logical set of reasons for voting the way I did, and he was actually clear in explaining those reasons. And then he did, I thought, one quite clever. Bradley was actually getting off some good one-liners last night, a thing afterwards. When pressed on it, on his mistakes, he, with some exasperation, turned to Gore and said, well, you know, Al has picked out three things that he said that I did that he thought were mistakes. I didn't think they were mistakes, but if I have to pick a mistake, fine. I voted against Greenspan, which is pretty funny, you know, and I thought an effective diffusing of it.
Okay.
There's been a degree here to which I thought Gore was a little better last night, and actually Bradley a little worse in how each dealt with the other. It had been all to Bradley's advantage, I thought, in the first few debates. Gore is clearly hot under the collar about the tone of Bradley's challenge. Gore was taking each debate as an opportunity to engage Bradley, while Bradley was taking each debate as an opportunity to engage the public.
What does Gore think about what Bradley's doing here?
Last night. What does Gore think?
What does Al Gore think Bill Bradley is up to here?
Well, first of all, the background noise, the subtext of the Bradley campaign is that Gore is just too corrupt. He's too corrupted by his associations and his history with Clinton, and he's been in the bunker, but he's been hanging out with the wrong crowd for too long. And to some degree, you know, I think that there's a kind of law of karmic exchange for everyone who's ever met Bill Clinton, whether it's when you shake his hand or when he looks you in the eye, forever after, he gets rewarded for all of your good behavior and you get punished for all of his bad deeds. And you could call it the Al Gore rule, who is a person of, you know, if Al Gore isn't smart enough or honest enough for you, you're never going to be happy in a democracy. This is about as good on those counts. That's about as good as it gets. And so the very theme of the Bradley campaign, the unstated rationale of Bradley's candidacy, isn't that he's got the right health care plan or that he can really deal with cities. The unstated theme is that Al Gore is too tainted to win. And Gore bridles against that. Gore, at least last night, was a little more restrained about it. And Bradley, I think Bradley's campaign has been stalling because of his inability to flesh out a real Democratic answer on things that really matter, on the larger issues. I think the legacy of Clinton was that he was spectacular at short-term judgments, but that the very structural issues he liked to talk about, he never really figured out an answer to.
I would agree.
And I think Bradley's in the same place.
I would agree with Bill, but with one caveat, which is I think that the Bradley may be in that place, and you did see that somewhat last night. He did seem to be sort of fumbling for the actual details, and as Bill said, it'd be nice if he had just turned and said, well, we can't work this out on the spot. We can't save Medicare in the next 20 seconds here on the air. But on running on the theme that Al Gore is tainted by not just too much time in Washington, that is not the issue this cycle, but too much time in the Clinton White House and too much time in that whole circle of money, very aggressive money politics. I think that is, even if he soft pedals it as he tends to do, I think that is very effective.
Does it matter whether Bill Bradley believes it or not? I mean,
it would be hard for him to believe it. I mean, the thing about it, I think, number one, it's interesting. Bradley is basically running a campaign not unlike the campaigns that Clinton and Gore ran, raising a lot of money from Silicon Valley, from Wall Street, doing well in Hollywood, keeping the message vague, and in a sense using another part of the Clinton message of 92, which is we have these large issues. This is exactly Clinton's. I mean, one of the sad things about Gore and one of the marks of what happened to Clinton and Gore over 8 years in Washington is that Bradley has been running their own 92 campaign against them, and they don't even recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
But Bradley's getting up and saying, just like Clinton told you, there's all this really big stuff to do. And I want you to trust me, because, like, you know, I also went to Oxford and Princeton, and I'm a really thoughtful guy, and everybody says I'm really well-informed. You know, I'm this year's wonk. And so trust me that I'm the kind of guy who will be able to work these details out.
There's a flip side to that, too, which I think that's right. And the flip side to it is in 92, Clinton Gore ran on change versus more of the same.
Yep.
This year, Gore is running on Bush's campaign. As Bradley is running Clinton's in 92, Gore is running George Bush's in 92. He's running on more of the same.
Absolutely. And Clinton is the guy basically who came to town with Bob Reich and left with Terry McAuliffe. And what Bradley's doing is underscoring what happened to them. But I still would say that, you know, some of my own ambivalence about the race is that having worked in the 92 Clinton campaign and worked in the White House in the 96 reelection, I'd kind of like someone to put this blueprint on the table for inspection.
Hmm.
I think the candidate who does that, neither party, by the way, wins hands down.
We haven't mentioned the gays in the military issue on which they both disagreed, but they may have laid down a very interesting record to chew on in the general campaign. We'll come back to that, but let's go to calls. We're talking about the Democratic presidential debate last night between Al Gore and Bill Bradley, with Bill Curry by phone from Connecticut, and Michael Kelly, the new editor of the Atlantic Monthly, in our studio in Boston. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Ernie is on the line. Welcome, Ernie.
Hi, thank you. I think that many Democrats, like myself, are just fed up with a sleaze in the White House. And I do think that they're looking for integrity in a candidate, and I think that this debate last night was more a matter of imagery than anything else. And I think in that, Bradley won it hands down. I think his answers were straight, were sharp, were right to the point. He comes across to me as being a really clean, honest, intelligent candidate.
Ernie, what was the sleaze in the White House connection here that you could hear in that debate last night?
Well, I couldn't hear it in the debate last night because they didn't discuss it. I mean, Bradley sort of hinted at it. But we all know what the sleaze in the White House was. I mean, we don't need a lesson in that. And I think the people are looking for, they're craving this, somebody with integrity that they can really trust. And I think that's the most more important almost than anything else, because the issues are pretty much they're both down the same line.
There is an undercurrent here. The caller said that people didn't actually talk about this out loud that much, and that's right, but you don't have to. A little bunker mentality remark goes a long way. But there's also an undercurrent here that happens when Vice President Gore opens his mouth. It cuts against him. And it's the backdrop of the Clinton scandals that is always there. When Al Gore turned to Bill Bradley and he said, trying to score an experience point on his theme that this is not an academic exercise, said the country can ill afford a president who makes a mistake in office that a mature, experienced person would know not to make. You can't help think for a second about Bill Clinton made a rather large mistake in office with Monica Lewinsky that a mature, experienced person would know better than not to make. And that, unfairly for Gore, it's no fault of his own, but that backdrop is right behind him, I think. Mm.
1-800-423-8255. We're trying to score the Bradley Gore debate in New Hampshire last night. 1-800-423-TALK. Michael is calling from a car phone. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning.
And to you.
Glad to be able to talk with you for a minute. My take is a little bit different. I don't really care which one of them won the debate last night. My concern is that I think it's vitally important that we have a Democrat in the White House for the next 4 years, and it would be appropriate for the two of them to continue both being very good candidates and let us make the choice between them. They both have good ideas. They both have wonderful things to say. It's very important that a Democrat be in the White House. It's very important that they not destroy each other before the election.
Important for what, Michael? To have a Democrat in the White House?
It's critical because, first of all, we may not have a Republican, we may not have a Democratic Congress. We've got health care issues. We have Social Security issues. We have a lot of domestic issues that need the type of attention that Republicans simply won't give us. I think we have to have a Democrat in the White House. I think we would do well with either Gore or Bradley. The voters are smart. Let us decide between the two of them. Let them continue to work on the good ideas they have.
So the choice between them isn't as important as the difference with the Republicans?
Absolutely.
I think they may think so, too.
I'm sure they would. I would agree with that, and I think Bill has already said this, but these are two serious substantive candidates. I don't think anybody would argue with that, and it's, actually that's one reason why Gore's digs at Bradley for lack of experience ring a little bit weak or hollow, I think. I think all of the candidates, with the possible exception of the governor of Texas, meet that the threshold, for most voters, would meet the threshold of experience.
Assuming for a moment the Republicans actually nominate George W. Bush, both Bradley and Gore will have enormous advantages in terms of intellect, experience, seriousness of purpose. It will still be interesting to me to see how they define the differences. I agree with the caller, Michael, who just called in, that the differences are great. They won't come across so clearly on budget and taxes. They won't come across clearly on international trade. They won't come across clearly on international relations. They won't come across clearly on the new technology economy based upon the debate so far. There are some places, both Gore and Bradley, will speak for gun control, which the country desperately needs, and after all the events of the last few years, it may be ready to have a national referendum on. Overwhelmingly, I believe that global warming is a huge issue. Republicans are completely out to lunch on it, and it's no longer something which obscure scientists are arguing about. There's a consensus for what's happening here, and for the whole need to transition to a sustainable economy.
Haven't seen any snow in Boston yet.
Yeah, it's just, the coral reefs are dying, the temperatures are coming down. Here we spend $100 billion on Y2K and the say-so of a half dozen technology consultants, and meanwhile, Omaha Beach is actually moving to Nebraska, and we're not taking action. So Gore, by the way, has been pressed by Bradley to deal with larger issues. Christopher, you were saying that he's a little bit more of an incrementalist, but Gore, who forgot to mention the environment, his lifelong pursuit in his announcement speech, interjected global warming last night. There's the need here to take a half dozen structural issues.
I still thought, Bill, that Gore, as he has in the past, came across last night as still somewhat programmatic, somewhat point by point, where Bradley did effectively, at least to me, present himself as, if not somebody who's fleshing out every policy, somebody who's got the big, broad, a liberal approach downright. Let's go for the fences here. Let's try the big stuff.
Again, first of all, I agree 100%. And I also agree that that's what the Democratic Party and the country want. The country places the big issues of health care and education at the top of its agenda. The good news for the Democratic Party is that for the first time in a generation, its objectives and the objectives of the nation as a whole are identical. The question, however, the nation has about us is whether we really have a program to go out and achieve those objectives. And that is, Bradley may be cruising for that sort of moment that, like the famous one between Gary Hart and Walter Mondale, where Walter Mondale says, you know, where's the beef? It's not enough. We have so many of our ideas in politics right now are metaphorical, you know, building a bridge to the 21st century, or thematic, compassionate conservatism. People want real ideas to back this stuff up.
Bill Curry, that's interesting, and I'm very much intrigued by the replay of the Hart-Mondale idea that you put forth. We're talking about the Democratic presidential contest with Michael Kelly and Bill Curry. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Magic Hour Communications, helping Fortune 1000 and fast-growing companies sell, market, and educate through videos, multimedia, websites, and presentations, magic-hour.com. And by PCs for Everyone, Windows 98, NT, and Linux-based computer systems and parts, building home PCs, corporate workstations, and servers, PCsForEveryone.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the New Hampshire primary connection between, talk about the debate last night between Al Gore and Bill Bradley. Both Democratic candidates agreed that gay people ought to be allowed and will be allowed in their administrations to serve openly in the military. And they both said, when questioned by Peter Jennings, that they would make it a requirement of their top military appointments to implement that sort of policy. Here first is Al Gore.
I would try to bring about the kind of change in policy on the don't ask, don't tell that President Harry Truman brought about after World War II in integrating the military. I would insist, before appointing anybody to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that that individual support my policy. And yes, I would make that a requirement.
And then following up on the same issue, here was Bill Bradley.
When you're president, you are commander-in-chief, and you issue orders, and soldiers are good soldiers, and they follow your orders. But my sense is that when you're president of the United States, military people are loyal to their commander-in-chief, whatever the policy is that the commander-in-chief calls for the country, and that's what I expect him to do if I'm president of the United States and we move toward gays in the military, which I intend to do.
Michael Kelly, the new editor of the Atlantic Monthly, what did you make of that exchange?
A clear distinction between Bradley and Gore here, and a terrific political blunder by Gore in terms of the general election. For Gore to say, and he said it twice when Jennings, who was almost incredulous, went back and made him confirm it, that he would require as a political litmus test any appointee to the Joint Chiefs of Staff to adhere to the same position, and that this would be the requirement as opposed to whether or not you'd be the best general to be the head of the Air Force or the Army or so on. He gave, I think, the Republicans a tremendous weapon to use in the general election, not just because it's a gay issue, because it's the question of politicizing the military, which is something that voters have an instinctive, deep fear and mistrust of. And I think Bradley...
I think you're buying the wrong premise of Peter Jennings' question. Why is it that's what they've been saying. This is I don't have to buy the president's political agenda. Wait a sec. He's the commander in chief.
But the key is not the command. He is not the commander in chief for political ideology.
It's not an ideological question any more than racial integration was. It had politics about it.
I think for many people it is an ideological question. Indeed, racial integration was also for many people and was an ideological question. I think that Bradley hit it exactly right when he said he would not have a litmus test, but he would be, as commander-in-chief, he would expect the military to carry out his orders, and good soldiers do carry out orders.
Is there a difference there? I don't get it. I don't hear it. Bill Curry, what do you think?
Well, there ends up being no policy difference at all, but I think Michael's onto something important here, though. Number one, you can't quite analogize this to what Harry Truman did. Harry Truman had to integrate the Army. The Army is already integrated with gay soldiers. The question is merely an elemental one of tolerance and constitutional duty. Number two, I thought that Bradley's answer was much closer to being correct. That Gore could easily have said, it is immaterial to me what the viewpoints are of the generals I appoint on any question, so long as they understand, and here I disagree with Bradley because not all good soldiers seem to have understood this in recent years, that they are not to politicize their positions, and that when I give an order, they implement it. And the fact of the matter is that a majority of the Army is going to oppose this under any circumstances and until it's been there for a year or two and they realize that most of their misgivings are unfounded. But that sense, the answer, I don't care so much what they think, so long as they follow my orders in this as in all things, I thought was pretty much on board and pretty much on the target.
Bill, this is Mike. Did you think that Al Gore made a political blunder there?
Well, I think, first of all, it's difficult for Democrats to speak up, as we have in every generation, for the rights of embattled minorities. There's always a price to be paid. From a strict political viewpoint, though, I would even say that the likelihood is that he pays, if anything, a very small price for this, because the Republicans have been out hounding gays, and you know, basically it's been their daily task for a few years now, and they've stopped because the public, the substantial majority of the public, is sickened by it.
What does George W. Bush?
And so Gore may not have a Republican who will, as they would have 4 years ago, be quite so quick to stand up and start trying to draw the line on this, because it will remind people of the sectarian intolerance of the Republican agenda.
I think he will face a Republican, either in McCain or Bush, who will draw the line on this. And the reason they will is that he gave an opening last night, which is they won't draw the line as a gay rights issue. They will draw it as a political litmus test issue. They'll say that if I'm president, I'm not going to have a political litmus test
for
the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I'm going to have the best general do the best job.
When he said litmus test, sure.
No. This is not you're not appointing a person to the Supreme Court to exercise a lifetime of legal judgment on new issues. You're putting a guy in a job to do.
But that's exactly the
policy.
That's exactly the point in our system that people feel, I think, quite sensitively about this. There is people want a clear demarcation between military and politics, between military and civilian.
Exactly, and they don't want some general saying,
"Wait
a second,
blurring of the line.
Your
here.
Policy in the Middle East is not my politics." Or
they also don't want the president saying, you've got to share my views on the Middle East.
Well, exactly. I think Bill's got it that right.
I think all three of us are a little bit like Gore and Bradley. We're much more in agreement than we're letting on.
Question is, what does George W. Bush do with this in the fall?
And I say that the politics aren't quite as clear as Michael says they are. That the Republican, the National Republican Party, dominated by, super conservatives from the South and the West, has paid too much of a price on both coasts and the Midwest for an intolerant agenda, and they won't know quite as easily what to do with things like this. And so, I don't anticipate that it's as much of an issue as Michael says. But I've been wrong before.
Me too.
1-800-423-825. You mean I'm the only guy that's never been wrong?
The only one.
Yeah.
1-800-423-825.
How'd that work it out for you?
255. I'm not always right, but
yeah.
I have
never.
Yeah. 1-800-423-TALK is the connection phone. Katie's calling from a car.
Hi, thanks for...
You've never been wrong, Katie.
I've been wrong frequently, but I'm one of those New Hampshire longtime residents who believes in live free or die in home rule, and I'll tell you, Bradley scared the hell out of me because he kept talking about all the things that the federal government was going to do, and not that... I mean, I'm a long-term Democrat, but... I worry
live
about
free or die Democrat? A live free or die Democrat?
I'm a live free or die Democrat, and I don't think that the federal government belongs in our schools and in our and necessarily controlling every aspect of welfare, et cetera. And the stuff that Bradley was saying was that essentially, you know, that's what he wants to do. He wants to control it all. And I believe very firmly in home rule and state control, and I think that a lot of New Hampshire people do. And I think
interesting question, Katie. Were they talking to New Hampshire last night or to...
No. I think that's the point. I mean, fundamentally, New Hampshire's going to decide this, because if New Hampshire, you know, basically if one or the other of them doesn't make New Hampshire, their campaigns are going to be severely weakened, I think.
Do you hear your friend saying this?
I hear a lot of people, I live on the seacoast, so we don't really belong to New Hampshire, but we're much closer to Massachusetts. But I think that the upstate, I think Bradley's going to be very scary, and I think what's going to happen is people are going to go into the voting booth and vote for McCain. Because I think that all those independent people are going to be scared about all this control that Bradley's talking about.
Michael Kelly.
There's a.
You've done time in New Hampshire.
I have done a fair amount. I went to a school there and had actually a terrific time. But there's a very interesting point about McCain here that the caller Katie brings up. There's a fascinating article out right now in the National Interest, of the Policy Magazine, by Walter Russell Mead, called "The Jacksonian Tradition," and he attempts in this to redefine American politics and policy in terms of Jacksonian versus Jeffersonian, Hamiltonian, and Wilsonian. And there's a lot he says here, but an essential thing he says is that this is still essentially a Jacksonian country, and in elections, the Jacksonian candidates, who are anti-big government in some ways but are not fit into a neat liberal or conservative category, very independent, very much like this caller, that the Jacksonian candidates are the ones who come out from nowhere, surprise the pundits, surprise the experts, and win.
Hmm.
And McCain is the Jacksonian candidate in this election, the only one.
Hmm. Bill Curry?
I think that there's some, but first of all, I didn't read the article, so I can't quite square it in those terms. And I think John McCain, I think a great deal of my work in the White House for a year, I was working on campaign finance reform in part because of other people's lack of interest, and I'm also with an organization that did normalization of relations with Vietnam, International Center in Washington, and so I've seen him at his best. He is still to this moment such a doctrinaire conservative on fundamental budget, minimum wage, et cetera, that I'm not sure that there's Jacksonian. You know, Jackson was against everybody. Jackson was against, in some ways, centralized governmental power, but also against centralized economic power. And in that way, he was the first sort of, you know, cross-cultural populist. Mm-hmm. I don't think McCain can quite make that claim yet, although his candidacy is fascinating. And he himself shows the spirit of such a person.
Stand by, Bill Curry. Michael Barone is on the line. He wrote the indispensable Almanac of American Politics, and he writes now for U.S. News and World Report. He's on a car phone in New Hampshire. Michael Barone, were they talking to New Hampshire last night, to the nation? How did you score it?
How would I score it?
Yeah.
Well, it was on the one hand, we'd say pugnacious. They argued, argumentative, and on the other hand, at some points, intellectually quite serious engagement in serious argument about public policy between Al Gore and Bill Bradley. I think in terms of demeanor, I don't think either one of the candidates helped himself very much if he were to become the Democratic nominee. I don't think that they helped their general election prospects a lot. Gore continues to be, was perhaps even more so than in his most recent appearances, striking negative chords. He loves to be argumentative. He makes the legitimate point that, it's okay to disagree on issues. His problem is that voters are not in all in the mood to hear that kind of argumentative stuff. They want consensus. They want agreement. They want an end to what they refer to as bickering. I'm not in entire agreement with the voters' attitudes on this, but the fact is, that's a reality with which candidates must deal, and I think Al Gore has been driving up his negatives among the general electorate.
Katie, the caller from New Hampshire, just said a moment ago that Gore and Bradley are driving voters to McCain at this rate.
Well, you know, there is such a yearning for a sort of positive tone, Chris. I mean, I find this quite striking, more so than probably any election since 1956. The times are good. And more than that, people are in a mood. I called it in the introduction of my current Almanac American Politics. They want a soggy rather than a crunchy political dialogue, to put it in the terms economists used in an editorial back in 1988. Crunchy is where you have clear-cut differences that have clear-cut consequences. Soggy is when you try to have a consensus that everybody agrees with and will bring all good things. Voters this year...
We've been waiting for that definition, Michael.
Yes. Well, voters
This need for a soggy, not a crunchy choice for the year 2000.
Well, everybody, you know, you can see them wanting to be soggy, or if you want to put it in a more neutral word, consensus-minded. You see John McCain doing that. You see George W. Bush doing that. You see Bill Bradley doing
Bradley's
that.
Trying to do it.
And you don't see Al Gore doing it. Oddly enough, though, he's the representative of the incumbent presidential party. The incumbent administration is supported by the president as no vice president, has been supported by a president ever before in American history.
Where do you come down on soggy versus crunchy, Michael?
Well, I actually...
Is the Atlantic Monthly going to be soggy or crunchy under your leadership?
We're hoping for a certain amount of crunchiness with maybe a little sogginess on the side. Actually, Michael and I worked together on a soggy versus crunchy cover story for National Journal last year, so we've talked about this before, and I think he's right that we are in soggy times now. The theme that has run through several elections in a row and is running through this one again is that both parties know that what's at stake here is the fight for primacy, for true majority party status in the post New Deal, post Cold War era, and that tends towards sogginess. That tends to drive everybody towards the middle because they're looking for the block in the middle that controls everything. The times are dictating sogginess more than the candidates.
Yeah, if I could just say one thing here, though, that
Bill Curry.
I mean, I on this whole soggy crunchy dialectic. I think.
How do you like your curry?
Yeah, I think look, the voter turns on the radio or the television and they hear one politician calling another politician a politician, and they don't know whether to laugh or cry. Distinguish between how the public feels about the tone of politics and the relevance of politics and how it feels about the substance. I think people are crying out for clear choices about how we shape our future. I think, again, that the politician who can actually put the clearest and most persuasive blueprint on the table for dealing with the kinds of structural issues that Bill Clinton raised in 92, and whoever it is, that person, to me, has an enormous advantage in this race. So I think that, in a sense, the pals and the consultants kind of miss the point. They know how sickened people are by the vituperativeness and baseness of their debate over the last decade, and they mistake that for the electorate wanting a disappearance of differences. They want the real differences sharpened. They just don't want so many sharp elbows.
Bill Curry, stand by. And Michael Barone and Michael Kelly. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about soggy versus crunchy. Bill Bradley versus Al Gore in New Hampshire. Gene is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Gene.
Hi, I'm recovering from soggy and crunchy here. But
you better make up your mind.
Yeah. No, but I will say I'm a Democrat, of course. But last night the debate turned me away from Bill Bradley. I've been going back and forth, but I turned away from him the last
Why?
Night.
You went toward crunch, away from sog.
Whichever.
Why?
Because number one, it's all well and good to sit up there and talk about these grand ideas as he does, and it's good to articulate them, but there's a long way between articulating an idea and getting it into function, you know. And for me, and I think for many Democrats, it's very hard to forget that Bill Bradley did indeed cut and run when things were really tough in the Senate. And it's hard for me to put confidence in someone who would do that and then would find himself in the presidency where he's going to have plenty of reasons to want to cut and run. You know, it's going to get bad, I'm sure, especially if we have a Republican Congress. So my feeling is that Gore may not come off as well as he should in public, but the fact remains he's a very competent person. And my feeling also is that perhaps the general electorate feels the same way. I'm not keen on the soggy and crunchy bit. I think, speaking for myself maybe, we're looking for ideas. We're looking for some remedies for some very obvious problems. Things aren't that great in this country. So, anyhow, for what it's worth.
Gene, you're very articulate, and you're the first person who's kind of registered a human reaction to this question of cutting and running. whether he did or didn't.
I think the caller's onto something there. I think that the cutting and running thing, which Gore has made a good bit out, is Gore is right to make a bit out of this, that this is a weak point for Bradley. Bradley tried his best shot last night. He's to date at countering it, saying, trying to turn it around. The voters are sick of this, saying to Gore, you know, Bill, a lot of people I talk to out here say there's too many people who are staying too long in Washington
right.
and fighting too much. But that is a defensive position. I think Bradley knows he's weak on this. And I'd say that there's one other...
But where do folks come down on this? I mean, do they believe in getting out of a morass
Well, I think that argument is appealing to strong partisans, people who, you know, are, as the lady, the caller said, Democrat, of course. Similar arguments appeal to strong Republican partisans. And, of course, the primary is where you will find those voters in higher concentration than you'll find anywhere else. So, you know, that has some effect. I think most general election voters don't feel that a person elected to the Senate has a moral obligation to continue there for the rest of his life.
We don't want you making fun of our accents, Michael.
Oh,
careful.
Sorry.
1-800-423-8255. Natalie is on the line. Hello, Natalie. Welcome. Are you there? Natalie? Say hello, Natalie. Or forever hold your peace. Hello, who's this? That's Michael.
Hello?
Natalie, are you there? Welcome.
Yes, I am.
Thank you.
I'm calling on the crunch side. And I think I very much like to say that I think trying to reach a consensus has really left us in very muddy water. I'm not in favor of the kind of nasty personal politics that have gone on, but I think we need a very strong commitment towards real ethical and moral policies. And I suppose I'm essentially a Keynesian. And
Ethical, moral, Keynesian crunch. You're a Gore person too, right?
Well, I suppose I would say that I'm more of a Gore than a Bradley person because of the cut and run. And I have a lot of question about the fact that Bradley keeps emphasizing the role of the private sector. I think that it has miserably failed in health care, and I think it has failed in a lot of things. And I think that this notion of maintaining the state's rights to decide welfare and aid and medical care is not appropriate. I think we need to take into consideration the general well-being in the country. And I want a president who's going to fight for the things that he really believes in and stick to those beliefs.
Natalie, I presume, I mean, I sort of hear a kind of Kennedy Democrat in your voice.
Well, I would... you mean a Ted Kennedy Democrat? Is that
yes.
what you're talking
yep.
about? Well, I tend to issue labels, but I think he has done an incredible job as a senator, and I think that I'd rather, you know, not so much label myself as to put myself on the line in terms of the things that I believe in.
You're there, Natalie. We take your position, and thank you. Quickly round the horn. What are they going to talk about next time, Michael Barone?
Well, I'd still be interested in hearing a little more about foreign policy. We may tonight from George W. Bush and John McCain, who have been talking about foreign policy more than some of the other candidates.
Bill Curry, what's the next issue to fight about?
I think first of all that what both these last two callers said, that looking for specificity is not just, I disagree with Michael on this one point, Michael, it's not just among ideologues. This is a deep hunger of the entire electorate, and that pressure be there. I also agree, however, that the New World Order is ripe for discussion in the Democratic Party.
Bill, I'm going to disagree with myself on the specificity, and I think you're right. And if Gore is smart, he will return to something I made fun of him for in the past, the urban sprawl issue. It turns out he's exactly right. It's the kind of thing people do want to hear about.
It's a New Hampshire issue, too. Michael Barone, Bill Curry, Michael Kelly, thank you enormously. Thanks to all the callers and the listeners. We'll do it again. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.